This is Carmen LaSalle with San Francisco Liberation Radio.
A bumper sticker struck my eye recently. On the left side, it said, Bush-Cheney 04. The middle contained an American flag, and the right side had the words, It's coming, hell on earth. I was puzzled. Was this a pro-Bush or an anti-Bush sticker? As I was on my way to teach a class, I asked my students what they thought it meant. One woman said she thought it referred to the belief by some born-again Christians that when the end of the world arrives, all those who are born again will be transported directly to heaven. This is called the rapture. Before the rapture, hell will prevail on earth, an inescapable hell for those who don't believe in Christianity. Not being born again, at least so far, I have no idea whether this will or won't happen, but the words, It's coming, hell on earth, have stayed with me. Certainly, if you take the news as it's reported by the media, it's easy to believe that hell is fast upon us. Wars, diseases, natural disasters, crime, corporate greed, they dominate every day's news. Is there no hope for a positive outcome? At the Rex Foundation benefit on October 14, 2002, Frances Moore LePay and her daughter Anna were the featured speakers. They had just co-authored a book, Hope's Edge, in which they wrote about their worldwide quest for people who are in cooperation with each other to improve their communities. In the talk, they discuss what's happening and what it means for the world. The two women alternate speaking to an audience of about 200 that filled the beautiful Victorian-era theater in San Francisco. Frances Moore LePay is a prolific author. She wrote her first book, Diet for a Small Planet, when she was only 26. It revolutionized mealtimes for many people in America, as its main premise was that animal protein isn't necessarily a component of a healthy diet. In fact, raising both cattle and the food to feed them is a wasteful way to use land, not to mention cruel to the animals. In her second book, Food First Beyond the Myth of Scarcity, she wrote that hunger is completely unnecessary and could be ended swiftly by a change in government policies around the earth. She had written 10 other books by the time of the benefit and has written another one since, You Have the Power, Choosing Courage in a Culture of Fear. Frances begins her talk by describing the events that led up to her decision to write Hope's Edge.
This is so exciting and fun to be here with you all. Thank you. Thank you, Patty and Sandy, and all that went into creating this evening together. I want to start by describing to you something of the genesis of this partnership with my daughter that has taken me to 5 continents, 9 countries, and changed me forever. And that actually began when my 2 children, I have a son, Anthony, who's a political journalist, they sat me down 3 years ago and they said, Mom, it is time to go back to your original intuition and follow the food. It's time to help our generation sort of make sense of the world in the way that your first book did in 1971. And of course, Anna teases me now and she says, you know, my mother wants you to think that this scene occurred in some beautiful organic garden or farmer's market, but actually it was a dark bar in New York City. But then they said, both of them said, and we'll help you. So my son became our champion, got us an agent, and got us, therefore, a publisher, and Anna became my research assistant for only a couple of months, though, because soon it was very soon, in fact, that I realized that she wasn't a research assistant, she was my partner in this undertaking, and she became fully the co-author of Hope's Edge. And of course, she says, it's not quite the same. To be promoted by your mother is not quite the same career move, but she did accept the elevation. And so this journey, as I say, began with my 2 children. Sitting me down and saying, you must do this.
Now Anna takes over. As this recording begins, she is discussing the relationship between the food-producing corporations, the public school system, and juvenile obesity.
And he was talking about how now our schools have become places where fast food companies make contracts and school districts make contracts for Pepsi and Coca-Cola to go in and provide our kids their great food products. And I was thinking, what does that mean about choice? Are our kids choosing to actually become more and more obese by the year? I know I was just talking with a nutritionist who said that just between this year and last, the Centers of Disease Control can actually track the obesity in this country growing to the point where now, I remember when we learned this statistic, it sort of just stuck in my head and has not been removed ever since. Now there are almost as many people dying every year from obesity-related diseases, in other words, from eating food, from obesity-related diseases as die every year from tobacco use. So we have 300,000 people, and it's growing. I think it's 330,000 by the latest estimate. People dying every year from what we're putting into our bodies. And you know, it raises that question, is this something we're choosing as a species to be killing ourselves in this way? And this also came really close to home over the weekend. My mother was giving a talk at the American Dietetic Association meeting in Philadelphia. And this is an association, I don't know if any of you are a member of it, it's one of the largest or the largest nutritionist association in the world. And we were both pretty stunned when we looked at some of their breakout sessions at this nutritionist conference. They were breakout sessions sponsored by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, Hormel, Mars Incorporated, Gatorade. My favorite one was Environmental Solutions to the Obesity Crisis. That one was sponsored by Mars Incorporated, the people who make those candy bars. I was thinking, what does that mean, environmental solution? You know, eat your candy bars, but then run around the block lots of times. And I was thinking about this, I guess it was just a little bit more than a week ago, when there was the latest huge national meat recall. 27.4 million pounds of sandwich meat was recalled. Due to, actually, I think they're saying actually people have died from eating meat that was contaminated. And conditional regard for our safety so that meat is getting out there that's actually making so many of us sick. You can ask this question too about the genetically modified organisms debate. I mean, I didn't volunteer to have myself be the guinea pig for the world to see how GMOs fare on our bodies when they were introduced into our food system, so that now the vast majority of GMOs are grown in this country. I don't think any of us sort of voted on the ballot box, yes, try out GMOs on us. And you know, I think that one of the themes that we'll come back to throughout the evening is this theme of what is it that we're choosing. And you know, that I think for so many of us, we feel that all of this is just sort of happening. You know, we didn't step up to the plate and ask for it. I was thinking about this a lot this weekend. I don't know how many of you were there, but this weekend I went to the Bioneers Conference in Marin, for some of you who are there. It's an amazing amazing conference, happens every year just across the water there. And I remember listening to Sebastio Salgado speak. He's one of my life's biggest heroes, the photographer. He's a photojournalist who's captured more of the vision of what corporate globalization has meant for this planet, I think, than anybody else. He was talking about his work now. He's doing work in Brazil to recreate the ecosystem where his family had a farm for generations. And he was talking to us about the vast and quick and speedy and complete loss of species and forest in Brazil. And you know, he was saying, we weren't asking for this as Brazilians, we weren't choosing this. And as I was thinking about all of these kind of examples that I wanted to share with you that have been very much on my mind today, I was watching my own reaction to it, and I think what was really striking to me was realizing that watching my own reaction was a lesson in just how much I've learned through this process of working on Hope's Edge with my mother. And what I mean by that is I think that, you know, I've been sort of able to let all of this in, to let it in that we have this this massive and unnecessary illnesses and death from the food system. I've been able to sort of let that in without being paralyzed by it. And I feel like that's a quality that we saw in so many of the people that we met around the world. And in our book, we call it the courage of the expanding heart. And what we mean by that is a sense that, you know, I think what this time asks of us is to be able to let our heart open up to all of the really profound grief in this world, the really profound suffering that we're witnessing, but to be able to understand we can let that in, and we can also at the same time feel the enormous sense of hope and inner witness that we, my mother and I, witnessed around the world. So I think it's that image of that courage of the expanding heart that I have really felt in myself as I was sort of thinking about all of these examples that I was just sharing with you tonight. And realizing that, you know, we don't need to be paralyzed by this. But I will say that 3 years ago, I was a very different person. I don't think I would be standing up here and saying what I just said. Three years ago, as my mother said, when my brother and I sat her down in a dark bar in New York City, I was living in New York City. I was in graduate school studying international affairs, and I felt really overwhelmed. I felt really overwhelmed and really paralyzed at the same time by all that I was learning in my graduate program. And I felt very much bombarded with this message coming at me from economists and pundits and journalists that we are at a point in history where we are we're being presented with these trade-offs, these impossible trade-offs. And it's this sense of being straitjacketed by these impossible trade-offs that I think was so paralyzing me. The sense that, you know, we're sort of being offered up either accept corporate globalization and its destructiveness for so many, or we'll have complete utter chaos. Either accept genetically modified organisms, even though there are so many questions about whether we even need them, or we'll have continuous and ever deepening hunger. You know, either accept chemical agriculture or we'll have starvation. And add to that, I think, the latest trade-off, impossible trade-off, except war or face endless terror. So I think it was that feeling of, okay, so what do you do in the face of these trade-offs, and asking, are these trade-offs for real? You know, is there something behind this story that we're hearing?
Frances picks up at this point.
So as Anna's describing how she felt, I think this is the way that most Americans feel, in the sense that this world that is emerging is not the world that any of us can recognize as ours. I mean, as Anna's saying, none of us get up in the morning and say, yes, I want to do my part today to contribute to global warming. And yet, I just learned that in 20 years, the snows of Kilimanjaro will be gone. None of us would get up in the morning and say, yes, I want a California in which 20 to 40%, Patty just told me this a few moments ago, 20 to 40% of women of color in this state are food insecure, meaning they don't know where the next meal is coming from. They don't have access to healthy food. And yet, in this very state, I was with the California Waste Management Board this morning, we throw away as much food as would feed the entire population of California for an entire year. We throw away in a year. That amount that we throw away in this state would feed all of the people who are facing starvation in Southern Africa, all of their food needs for 3 years, but we throw away in one. So none of us get up in the morning and say, yes, this is the kind of world I want. So in a way, I've spent the last decades of my life trying to figure out what it could be that allows this to happen, for us to be living in a world in which we don't feel like we're choosing and we're not sure anyone is choosing. It just feels like it's happening. What could be powerful enough? And over the years, I came to believe that there's only one thing that powerful, and that is the power of ideas. And I was very influenced recently, I say recently in the last 5 years, by the work of Eric Fromm, and some of you of my generation will remember his influence in the 70s in particular. But there was a book that I had not read until about 5 years ago called The Anatomy of Human Destructiveness. And there's one sentence in that book that we use in Hope's Edge, and if you'll please excuse Eric's non-gender correct language, Eric Fromm says, "It is man's humanity that makes him so inhumane." And what Eric Fromm is getting at And what he goes on to describe is the unique human capacity to construct ideas about reality that then really determine what we can see and what we cannot see, what we believe human beings are, and therefore what we think is possible. That we live within what he calls frames of orientation, that is our nature. We call them mental maps. Now, that's all well and good if the mental maps that through which we construct reality, if they're life-serving. But what happens if you and I are alive in a moment in the evolution of our species in which the dominant mental map, one going global, is not life-serving? In fact, it's put us on a death march. This is the era in which we live, I believe, and this is the only way that I can make sense of it. And so what Anna and I try to do in Hope Sedge is to tease out the thought traps of the dominant map. What are the big ideas through which we see the world? And one undergraduate put it to us, it's like looking through a screen. You look through it long enough and you don't realize you're looking through a screen at all. And so it's invisible. We don't even see it. So we try to pull out the dominant ones. And in interest of time, I'll just try to summarize several key ones. And the first one being is, what does it mean to be a human being? The dominant message of what it means to be a human being that we've been absorbing now for a couple of hundred years, still a blink in historical time, is a caricature of human possibility. A caricature that says we are nothing but these selfish little accumulators. We are nothing but these egotistical materialists. And if that's all we are, then it follows inevitably that we have to turn over our fate to an impersonal mechanism, the market. Because we, being these egotistical materialists trying to subdue nature and each other to get ours, I mean, you know, we're really incapable of democratic deliberation. Remember that idea? So the best we can do, and it's a good thing we finally figured it out, is to turn over our fate to what I've come to call the primitive market, or market fundamentalism, as George Soros says we used in Hope's Edge, in this idea that not any kind of market, of course, I mean, the market mechanism could work in many ways, but one particular kind of market, which is premised on one, I think, primitive notion, really, and that is simply the whole thing is run by one driver, which is highest return to wealth. And yet we come to believe that a system built on highest return to wealth is going to work to create societies that are livable. I think if we just look at that, it's no surprise at all that now in the food industry, just 10 corporations, and narrowing and narrowing and narrowing, just 10 corporations have come to control one half of all the food items. So if you walk into a supermarket, you may see 30,000 different products, but they're just 10 corporations. 10 corporations on whose board sit 138 people. Now, as the control over the food industry has gotten narrower and narrower, as Anna says, we've gotten wider and wider. And this is no coincidence, because my favorite chapter in Diet for a Small Planet is called Who Asked for Fruit Loops? And I asked the reader to go through, who asked for Fruit Loops? Well, if you are the CEO of Foods Conglomerate or whatever, then every strategy you come up with to feed the bottom line ends up feeding our bottoms. In other words, putting weight on us. That was supposed to be I'm trying out a new soundbite tonight while I'm going to scratch that one. But anyway, the idea is that it's inevitable, it's built into this notion of the primitive market. So combine this notion of ourselves reduced to this caricature that we must turn over our fate to this primitive notion of the market built on highest return to wealth. And if you go along that far, then it's true. We do have few choices. And we do have to deny our basic, deeper, more complex needs that without which we wouldn't have gotten to the point we have as a species, which Anna and I saw expressed again and again throughout our journey. And we identified them as two needs that get lost or get suppressed and denied. the need for connection in real community, not just by what brand names we wear, but real community to connect and also to affect the world larger than our own survival, that these are very deep human needs we heard expressed in Kiswahili, Kikuyu, in Bengali, and Hindi, and Portuguese, and on. But these are the needs that are denied in the dominant mental map. And so then, this is why I would say that it's no surprise to me that, and this is my own guess, of course, intuition, I guess all of this is, but that the reason that the World Health Organization can report today that depression is now a worldwide epidemic that is is the fourth leading cause of loss of productive life, and estimated in 20 years will be the second leading cause of loss of productive life. It helps explain to me this denial of our real selves, helps explain to me, or at least our more complex selves, this denial that we live in, helps explain to me why it was reported last week that suicide now kills 50% more people than homicide kills. We are denying who we are. And so then I have to ask, why again? Why don't we listen to our deeper needs? Why don't we express these needs to connect in real community and to affect the larger world? And my one word answer to that is fear. My one word answer to that is fear, that fear keeps us in denial. And in this, I think we need to expand our hearts, as Anna said, to have some compassion for our species. But this is really the premise of so much of our book, is that we human beings, in tribal form, understanding that to step outside of the tribe, to separate from the pack, could easily mean death. But we are alive in human evolution at a time when the pack itself, the dominant tribe, is on a death march. So our survival means doing something that we're not used to doing, and that is breaking with the pack in order to survive. So in a sense, our fear is very understandable, and that's why I'm saying that compassion is in order. So breaking with the tribe can bring up a lot of fear, and yet that is exactly what we saw people doing on our journey that Anna will now pick up.
I just noticed it says, please speak loud and clear. So I'll try to do that. I think that one of the things that was so striking to us as we were setting out, we went to Bangladesh and India, Kenya, Brazil, Poland, France, and two places in the United States together. And for me, I sort of ended my last part by talking about this straitjacketing of the false trade-offs. And what was so clear to us as we traveled to all these places is just what a farce those trade-offs are, and just how much there is around the world this emergence of whatever term you want to use to call them, you know, a tribe or new movements or places where people are showing that other paths are possible. I remember at the time when I was a graduate student and reading diligently, you know, cracking the books to prepare myself for Hope's Edge, reading Thomas Friedman's book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, thinking that's where I would find, you know, great information as groundwork for our book. Thomas Friedman is a now three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, writes for the New York Times, and his book, The Lexus and the Olive Tree, was all about helping us understand globalization. His basic thesis is that there is no other path possible, you know, that these trade-offs are for real, there's no other path. And I remember reading this, of course, before I actually saw that wasn't true and then traveled and met all these amazing, amazing people in social movements. But I remember this one line I'll never forget from his book, and we use it in Hope's Edge. Thomas Friedman is so sure of himself, and he says, you know, basically all we have out there is global corporate capitalism, is basically his point. But he puts it this way, because he writes very colorfully. He says, there is no more lemon lime, there is no more chocolate chip mint, there is no more strawberry swirl, there is only plain vanilla, and North Korea. Of course, that was before North Korea became part of the Axis of Evil, so really now, you know, really nobody would choose North Korea. But his basic, you know, what he was saying, what's plain vanilla? Plain vanilla is what we call corporate globalization, this increasing control of corporations over all of life, and the erosion of protections around everything from what I consider something as sacred as seeds to complete control over something as important as food. And so, you know, I feel like when we took this voyage, it was really seeing that there's a whole lot else out there besides just plain vanilla or North Korea. And one of the places where we really saw that so vibrantly was in Brazil, where we went to meet with people in the Landless Workers Movement, which is one of the largest social movements in Latin America. And the movement started with a very simple premise, which is basically the Constitution of Brazil now says that Brazilians have a right to claim unused idle land and farm it. And that basically, if land isn't being used for a productive and social purpose, it's the right of the people to farm it, to use it, to make it vibrant, and to bring it to life. Of course, the 1% of landowners who control half of the land, or almost half of the land in Brazil, were not so eager to be watching this constitutional clause come to life. So this movement emerged out of many social movements in the Catholic Church to basically do civil disobedience and make the government make good on its promise. And over the years, the movement has settled 250,000 families on formerly idle land. And what was striking to us, though, is that talking to people in the movement, the common chorus from so many people was that we started this whole movement thinking the problem is land. We need to get, the problem is inequality of land, and we need to get on the land. And that is the source of hunger and the source of so much of what's holding us back in Brazil. But they said, you know, as soon as we got land, we realized that land is just the beginning. You know, once you get land, you have to ask, okay, well, what do we do with it? What do we grow here? How do we want to grow it? What kind of communities do we want to have? What kind of schools do we want our kids to be in? What kind of questions do we want our kids to be asking about the kind of country they're growing up in? And so that over the years, this movement has evolved to not just a land reform movement, but to a movement that's created thousands of schools, that's created a whole network of people that are really asking that question, what kind of communities do we want? And I remember talking to a number of people in the movement. We were sitting with them, and they were telling us that the Landless Workers Movement has started the first organic seed line in Brazil. And so we said, well, you know, what was your motivation for doing this? Was it because of, you know, as farm workers, people tilling the land, you were being poisoned by the chemicals and realized for your own good you didn't want to be using chemicals anymore? And they sort of looked at us like we were complete idiots. And they said, you know, we're growing this food for people. Why in the world would we go through all of this trouble to grow the food, to harvest the food, and to sell the food, knowing that the food that we're selling to our consumers might be making them sick? And, you know, we sort of looked at each other and it was like, yeah, you know, if you can be asking yourself, how do I want to grow food? That's the answer you would give. And so it was really incredible for me, having grown up in the United States, having been told, you know, cooperation is impossible, you can never work together, to see it really brought to life in the Landless Workers Movement was just really incredible for me. And for those of you who want to know more about getting involved with the movement, there's somebody here from the Friends of the MST, and we have material about that on our table over there. But coming home from this journey to Brazil, I remember diving back into the Lexus and the Olive Tree because I thought I remembered that Thomas Friedman had also talked about Brazil. And I remember getting to that section in his book, and I was struck by the fact that Thomas Friedman doesn't mention the MST in his book. In fact, he talks about something called Semterra, which he describes as a social movement, or not even a movement. He just says they're the only people who are sort of upset about what's going on in terms of economics in Brazil. And he said these people just live by the sides of the road, and they steal trucks, and they rob banks, and they have no flag, and they don't have a manifesto, they don't have any ideology. They're just this ragtag group of very unruly people. And we were struck by the fact that, you know, he hadn't, how could he look at Brazil and not have addressed the fact that, you know, it was the landless workers movement was such a huge force. So we actually asked him, said, Thomas Friedman, why didn't you mention the MST? And he said he'd actually never heard of them when he wrote his book. Never heard of them. You know, when we were in Brazil, we got off the plane and every single newspaper we picked up, we don't even speak Portuguese and we could get it that land reform was, you know, on every single cover of every single paper. It's a, you know, the hot political question. And to me, it goes back to what my mom was saying when she was speaking about these thought traps. You know, that Thomas Friedman had was trapped in his own thought. What was his thought? That there isn't anything out there like the landless workers movement. And so when my mom was talking about the power of ideas, you know, I think that I, through that experience with Thomas Friedman, I really get what she said. You know, it's so powerful that it can literally blind us. You know, like it blinded Thomas Friedman. He literally didn't see it. And I do believe, I don't think he was blind, you know, I don't think he really saw it. So to take you to another place a little bit closer to home than Brazil, one of the other places that we went to see these other paths emerging was actually right here in San Francisco and in the East Bay. And one of the places that we went to see other people asking these questions, what choices do we have and what other paths might be possible, was in Berkeley. We went to, on a totally different scale, but I think on an equally important kind of message about what we can do, going to a school in Berkeley and really looking at what's happening with the Edible Schoolyard in Berkeley, which many of you probably are familiar with. It's actually just one example of now emergence all around the country of schools that are and communities that are saying, wait a second, you know, we're bringing our kids to these schools to learn, to be educated, to be fed with information. Why should we let them at the same time be fed by Taco Bell and McDonald's and fast food that is not going to nurture them? And so we went to the Edible Schoolyard to see the school that is actually growing food, harvesting food, and having kids harvest the food and serve it to each other. And it was interesting to hear the similarities between talking the community in Berkeley and the conversations that we had in Brazil of teachers and students asking themselves, you know, what kind of world do we want? Do we want it to be a place where kids can actually sit around a table and eat together and eat food that's not going to make them sick and not going to make them overweight? Is that the kind of world we want? And we were really struck by the bravery of the people who launched the schoolyard when they told us that the first meal they decided to serve the kids was kale. And, you know, we were thinking, that's not exactly the way to entice middle school kids into eating food from the garden. They said the teachers, many of the teachers were very skeptical, but they said, you know, since the kale was organic and fresh and just picked and was delicious and flavorful, the kids actually really enjoyed it, so much so that one of the teachers told us that there was one kid that was actually kind of hoarding kale leaves and putting it under his napkin for later because he was so into the kale. So, you know, when you ask the question, what is it that kids want? You know, well, kids are choosing, aren't they choosing this food that we might not think is so great, but aren't they choosing it? And whenever I hear that question, I think, well, just look at the advertising budgets of McDonald's or, you know, these fast food companies that they have to convince us it's what we want. My mom was just telling me that she had just heard that what the government spends for nutritional education in this country is equal to just 1/5 of the advertising budget of Altoids mints. So I think it's a good sign about how much we have to be convinced what it is we should be consuming.
And we hear again from Frances.
I want to stay in Brazil, or go back to Brazil, right. But one of the, as Anna's talking about the community garden, the school garden, the school garden, I was thinking back to your story about the MST, because there the children were also very much involved, and in fact, you know, as the parents began to think, what kind of communities do we want now that this is the largest social movement in Latin America, and 17 million acres of land involved in this, and a lot of community building going on. And so they were thinking, well, they want to ask their children too to begin to realize they have choice. And so they told us that they teach philosophy to their little kids. And we said, philosophy to the little kids in grade school? Philosophy? And they then, so we probed, and you know, what does that mean? And they said, well, it means that in our schools, we ask our grade schoolers to consider the question, what kind of community do I want? What kind of Brazil do I want? And I think that was, for us, really getting at this question of choice at a much, much deeper level than we generally think of it here. But while we were in Brazil, we also visited the fourth largest city in Brazil, actually a place that kind of reminded us of San Francisco, just because it's a lot of hills and very beautiful. And we were drawn to Belo because we had to go to talk to these people who the city, in 1993, the city government had declared food a right of citizenship, good food, healthy food, a right of citizenship. Now, on the surface, this looks like any market-driven capitalist city, and yet the city government said, wait a minute, even if you're poor and can't afford food in the market, you're still a citizen, and therefore we, the government, are still responsible to you. So how do we fulfill that responsibility? And so that shift of mental map, that shift out of simply the notion that we have to turn over our fate to this primitive market mechanism, this unleashed a lot of creativity, dozens of different examples of things that just began to emerge over through this collaborative effort between the municipality and citizen groups and church groups and labor unions, things that pretty much could happen in any city, taking city-owned plots of land, small little pieces of land that was unused, and making it available to local organic farmers on the condition, two conditions, that they would sell it at a price that the poorest people in Belo Horizonte, maybe I didn't mention the name of the city, it's Belo Horizonte, which translates as beautiful horizon, that even the poorest people in the inner city could afford that produce, and they also had to agree to take trucks of fresh produce out into the poorest favelas around the city on weekends, but keep it in the reach of the poorest. This shift of mental map also meant that they saw, well, the federal government is giving us 13 cents for every child for school lunches. What would happen if instead of buying corporate processed food, which we know is not healthy for our kids, what if we used it to buy local organic food? And they were already seeing the impact of this on the nutrition levels of the kids. They said, wait a minute, the market works only if people have full information. But in our inner city, the poorest people are paying more for food, and surely they don't even know where to get the cheapest food. And so the city government united with a local university to post the cheapest prices for 45 food commodities in bus stops and broadcast it over the radio so that people wouldn't be victimized by price gougers. And on and on, and they began to see abundance before they had seen waste. You know, I mentioned earlier that I just learned this morning that as much food is thrown away in California as we eat here in a year. But there they began to see things thrown away. Once they shifted the mental map, they said, wait a minute, we're throwing away eggshells, we're throwing away manioc leaves. These could be purified, processed into a flour to fortify, this very nutritious stuff, to fortify rolls that are then made available, breadstuffs for school children, for all the school children of our city. And again, they've been able to see the nutritional benefit for kids. And so we just were amazed at all of these things that started to bubble up with the shift of map toward food as a right of citizenship. So at the end of our stay, we sat down with Adriana Aranha, who is the coordinator of these various initiatives. And so we sat with Adriana and we said, do you realize you are completely out of step with the whole direction of the world? It's going toward market is the only thing that can work, and government can't do anything right. And you're saying that actually there's a role for government, and that government can collaborate with citizens and actually be part of the solution? Do you realize how profoundly out of step you are? And Adriana went on and on and on in Portuguese. We didn't understand a word she was saying. but she was very animated. And then she went on, and then her eyes started to tear up. And then we got really eager for the translator to interrupt her and tell us what she's saying. And turns out that what had brought tears to her eyes is she said, "Yes, I knew how out of step we were and are. And I knew how much hunger there is in the world." She said, "What upsets me so much, though, is what I didn't know. And that is how easy it is to end it." And it kind of took our breath away. It reinforced my sense, however, that what she was really saying to us is that it is easy if we can do two things. If we can walk through that fear, or with that fear of difference, of being different. She was clearly out of step. And if we can break free from this dominant mental map that leaves us without choice.
Anna wraps up.
And I also think, you know, when we talk about sort of where is it that we're not, why aren't we seeing that happen more? And I began by saying that one of the things that I learned in talking with everybody that we met in writing Hope's Edge was this idea of the courage of the expanding heart, of being able to let in both the suffering and see how much is emerging. But what I also think, we were so clear, what we saw so clearly, and I think it connects with what Adriana was saying, what Adriana was feeling, is that I came to realize there's a really different understanding I have now of the impact that we can each have in the world. And I think I used to really buy that phrase, what difference does anything we do really make, because we're just a drop in the bucket? You know, feeling like everything I began with talking about are such insurmountable, huge obstacles that anything we do is just a drop in the bucket. Well, hearing Adriana's story, it's so clear how what they're doing there isn't just a drop in the bucket. You know, they're really making this major, major change. And what my mom didn't mention is that Adriana told us at the end of our stay with her is that everything that they've been doing has been done on just 1% of the city budget. But I do think for many of us who might not be running city governments, who our daily actions may be on a much different scale than that, still really feel like, well, it whatever we do, it really is just a drop in the bucket. And I've come to really think differently about that and feel that we're not feeling like we're a drop in the bucket. I think that what a lot of people feel is they're just like drops in the Sahara. You know, the drop evaporates before it even hits the ground. And I think this image or this metaphor came to us when we were on our book tour and we were in Seattle and Portland, where it rained pretty much as soon as we got off the plane until we got back on the plane. You know, we're thinking drops, okay, image of drop and bucket. A bucket actually fills up really, really fast. And we were thinking, you know, that problem isn't that we feel like we're dropping the bucket, it's that so few of us feel like we see the bucket. You know, we don't feel like our drops are adding up. And so what's so exciting about being able to share these stories in a place like this, which we never get to do, that's not only really inspiring and beautiful, but also has all these other organizations here, is I feel like, you know, it sort of brings to life the bucket. You know, I feel like we're in it. You know, all of these different organizations are part of the bucket we're talking about. Everything that we witnessed in Writing Hope's Edge is creating that bucket. It's out there and it's real and it's not spotty. It's not just a few people who are crazy trying to do something different off in some corner of the world. It's really, we saw it everywhere. And so I think it's that sense that actually we should feel really proud to be a drop in the bucket. You know, that is a really, really significant thing. And I think we also have to remember that, you know, being a drop in the bucket, it's a choice. We have to make choices to choose to be dropping into buckets. You know, it doesn't just happen. But I think in order to even feel like we should be acting, that we should be dropping, that we should be making these choices, connects us back to I think the theme that Patty and Sandy opened the evening with, this question of what do we mean by hope. And how can we, with a straight face, be talking about hope on a day like today and in an era of what we're faced with right now? And so what we wanted to end with was just our learnings about hope from traveling around the world and from meeting the incredible people that we met. And for me, as a young person, relatively young person, I think that it really transformed my understanding of hope. I mean, I used to feel like hope was pretty much, talk about cheese slicer, you know, hope, it was pretty much the cheesiest, I felt like, word in the English language, that it meant that you had to basically be, you know, have your head in the sand or your head in the clouds. You know, you couldn't really be looking at what we're faced against, up against, and have hope. And I used to feel like it was sort of this easy tally you could do. You'd sort of look at how good things were, look at how bad things were, you'd add it up together, and whatever you got in the end would give you reason to either have hope or not have hope. And what I think we so witnessed around the world is that hope isn't this easy calculation you can do, and Patty's quote from us touched on this at the beginning, that hope, it's not something that we seek out there in evidence. It's what we become by choosing to act. And we saw that everywhere we went. We saw people who were faced up against the world's most daunting obstacles who were choosing to act and who were some of the most hopeful people I've ever met. So I remember this so striking when we were traveling through Kenya and visiting members of the Greenbelt movement there, this village-based movement throughout the entire country that is now in 6,000 villages, that's been started as a tree planting movement that's now become a pro-democracy movement in Kenya. And collectively they've planted 20 million trees. But yet these are women who are facing a ruthless dictator who's jailed and beaten and arrested their leadership. They're women who are facing incredible alcoholism in the villages and domestic violence. And yet they were so hopeful, not in an ignorant or naive way, but in this really deep, really edgy, different way. And so I'll just leave us with the words that we saw, I think, that really epitomize this across the t-shirts of the Greenbelt Movement members that we met with. And their phrase is just really, really simple. Across their t-shirts was just the phrase, "As for me, I've made a choice." Thank you.
You have been listening to Frances Moore LePay and her daughter Anna. They spoke at a benefit for the Rex Foundation at the Great American Music Hall, San Francisco, California, in October of 2002. Information about the Rex Foundation can be found at www.rexfoundation.org. That's R-E-X, foundation.org. This recording is a production of San Francisco Liberation Radio, an online radio station located at www.liberationradio.net and a provider of quality content for the internet. Carmen LaSalle is the producer. The music is by Chris Potter. Thanks for listening.